Before we, again, I'm Dan Gibbons from City Club, and I'm just saying welcome. And before we invite our guests of honor up, we always like to acknowledge so many people that are in this room. And I just did that with so many of the sponsors. And then there are a few others, some elected officials and officials and whatnot. But it's good because it's important that you're all here. You all took time out of your day to be here. And that's for a reason. You all, in your own way, are moving Chicago forward, have done so much to move Chicago forward, and there's so many young people are doing that, that are emerging leaders. So just want to mention a few people, a few of those, and again, if you could hold your applause, because it's such a great room, and I can't get to everybody, but Alderman Brian Hopkins is here, and I don't know where, because he was fought over by two tables. Thank you, Alderman, that's where you landed. Al Friedman is here from River North, and his son Jason is also here, good friends of the City Club. Carlos Ramirez Rosa, the CEO of the Chicago Park District, is here, as is Kristen Reynolds, the CEO of Choose Chicago. Kara Bachman from the Chicago Sports Commission brings so many great sporting events to Chicago, and some of those take place at Navy Pier. Where's Marilyn Gardner? Marilyn is here also. Charlie Jones, Four Leaf Productions, welcome back. Charlie, I'm trying to get him to just stick here in Chicago. We're getting close. Jack Levin from the Chicagoland Chamber. Jack's been a busy man. Andy Zopp, Cleveland Avenue, and former World Business Chief. Another World Business Chief, Michael Fosnock, is here, now with Clayco, you know. John Simpson from Broadhaven is here. The former Senate President, John Cullerton, is here. Z. Scott from Chicago State joined us. Rosanna Ander from the Crime and Education Labs. I know I'm missing people. John Kelly, thank you for being here. He's busy too. Andy Glore in Sterling Bay. So many people that in every way have you've all done so much and are doing so much more. And I'm sorry if I'm missing any. There are some, like, I call them recovering public servants. Right in front, Lisa Schrader is here. Joe Deal is here. David Reifman is here, the former Commissioner of Planning and Development. Mike Rumler, I saw Joan Coogan. I'm sorry if I'm missing any. Oh, recently, I mentioned Lisa. Rosa Escareño, former Park District CEO. There's Rosa. Mara Georges. Just so many great people. You've all done so much. It's so important that we're all here together, not just to hear this man, but to talk with each other and keep this. Keep this great civic institution that is City Club going, but also move our city forward at a time when it's needed more than ever. So thank you for allowing me that time to mention those folks. And you're all here to see one person, though, and it's certainly not me. So if you could please join me in welcoming our guest of honor back to the City Club, Mayor Rahm Emanuel. Ambassador Rahm Emanuel, Mayor Rahm Emanuel, Chief Rahm Emanuel. I think the top of your resume, though, is City Club Speaker, right?
Yeah. Right up there.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
Joe Deal can attest to this. Last night, I was plowing through questions, and I have about 40 of them, and I had it all ordered.
40?
They were global. We were going to go global. We're going to go American politics. We're going to go local. And then Kate, my wife, yelled and said, take a minute and say goodnight to the kids. And so I went upstairs and said goodnight to the kids. Little prayer
good,
time.
Good call.
Yeah, right? Yeah, and my parents are in the room, too, so they're going to agree with that. But it reframed my thinking a little bit. And if you're up for it, we can maybe still hit on some of those topics, but I thought it'd be nice to just have a conversation that maybe we're not going to see on CNN. Talk about what really matters. You know, talk about... We can get to those issues, because some of those issues really do matter. But if you're up for it, talk a little bit about that, and maybe a little bit about family.
Oh, okay. Well, before we start with my family, I think if everybody just gets a minute today, think about Darren Bailey. It's one of those things that you can't prepare for, and I don't want to say the trite, put them thoughts and prayers, but take a moment, try to reach out. It's got to be the loneliest moment for him and his family. Switching gears, I'm very fortunate. I got all three kids, as Amy and I would say, are launched, healthy, and in good place. Zachariah is finishing up 7 years in the Navy. As an intel officer, Alana is a Navy Reserve, and she's just started at the University of Chicago. I keep doing that when I go. University of Chicago Business and Law. And then Leah is a leading expert in national security and climate change, although you can't say climate change, so resilience. And everybody's healthy. And Amy just finished the Chicago Marathon. I will probably get killed for saying that. But she, when we were in Japan, doesn't everybody pick up doing marathons in Japan? So she's now done 6 marathons. So yeah, so everybody's healthy, everybody's in good shape.
That's good. That's what matters, right?
And we're going to get together, everybody. My mother's 93rd birthday, and I'm going to learn very quickly everything I've done wrong. She can't hear anything, but she'll tell me exactly what I did.
They got through Japan. You got through D.C.
Way you should think about it is Japan got through Rom.
Okay.
And I'd just like to say they're still an ally.
I told you, we're going to get to some of these issues. Just roundabout ways. So is Chicago back? Is Chicago home again? You've been through this before.
Yeah, no, Chicago.
Are you home? Yeah. Are you back home?
The wedding dress is still in the basement. No. I just had it. It's like therapy. I just had to get that off my chest. No. Chicago's home. We're in the same home we've had since when I moved back from the Clinton White House years, and that's where we're living.
Great. Great. You don't know this.
Don't visit, but that's...
you mentioned Leah, and I didn't intend to bring this up, but speaking of that home, when you got rid of your piano, I happen to know a guy that moves pianos, and he called me and said, "You're moving in. I'm moving a piano out of the house." The guy told me to just get rid of it. And I said, "Is it an upright?" He goes, "Yeah, it's a Story and Clark. I'll take it."
We had to make room for the other piano.
Well, so I have your old piano in my house.
Well, I'm not giving you the new one.
And I didn't believe him, really. I didn't believe him until the sun kind of hit it the right way in the morning, and Leia's name is carved into the piano on the backboard. You can't make that up.
I really appreciate you sharing that with everybody.
It's about family, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so you're there's so much we can tackle. But what matters? You're famous for lists. You know, you always had your lists of things. And Joe, everybody here that worked for you knows that. What's top of your list right now with all the everything that's going on in
this interview? I had a great time. Fascinating. It's not like my Wikipedia page is empty, but to go to Japan, represent the United States, a part of the world I had not been. I wrote this for the Post, learned a lot about, obviously, Japan, the alliance, China. But being away from America, you learn a lot about America. And you learn a lot about what I would say to you is we are now in the middle of one of the biggest challenges we've had. If you look at American history, we've never faced a country that's 3 times our size, let alone in scope and scale. China is very focused on the future, very focused on what they got to do to invest in their future to win. And what I mean by that, for a long time, the United States adopted this perspective that we're going to have strategic competition. And the Chinese Communist Party and President Xi made a decision a while back, 2012, that they're not going to be strategic competitors, but they're going to be a strategic adversary. That's a very different role. And core to my view, and core to why I ran for mayor, but core to my existence, is education. And we have the lowest reading and math scores in 30 years. And just by way of reference, a lot of people say, you know, one-third of our kids can do reading and math at grade level. Well, the other way to think about it is two-thirds cannot. And if you want to compete against a country that's three times your size, you can't do it with only a third of the kids, or a third of the future employers and employees working and capable. And I think worse than that, you know more about the president's position on windmills than you do what he thinks about the NAEP scores. You know more about his position on what he wants to do on the east wing of the White House than what he wants to do for kids' future. And so to me, the core issue, one of the biggest pieces that's challenging America, is the fact that we are failing our children. Our children aren't failing. We're failing them. And so to me, that's top of mind. Then most importantly on that is the competitiveness of America. Now, when I say started when I was in Japan, America never loses when it invests both in Americans and America. And we took our eye off the ball. And we're paying a price for it. So thinking through kind of the things that I think are top of mind for that.
So sticking with, well, I guess both education. We had a conversation here a week or 2 weeks ago. It was mostly about housing. But part of the conversation was about the American dream. Uh-huh. And it was basically like, is it time to reframe the American dream?
No, it's time to actually rekindle it.
Rekindle it?
Yeah, look, it happened over... It didn't happen 4 years. It didn't happen over 4 months. It's happened over a long period of time. We had a basic bargain. American dream. This is my definition. I think there's a consensus. Being able to afford a home, save for your kids' education, your retirement, and your health care. There are other pillars that make up the American dream, but those are the four kind of consensus. One state, one data fact, just to kind of drive the point home. In 1950, 50% of the country that was 30 or younger were married and owned a home. Today it's 12%. Can't afford it. My kids are going to be okay. But that's not how we score it. You can't have an American dream in which 10% of the children can afford to start, buy a home, start a family, invest and have the time and save for their retirement, and 90% are locked out. It used to be you kind of strived to achieve the American dream. Today it's a struggle to stay in it. People want a shot and they're getting the shaft. And to me, you got to rekindle that it's accessible. Now, there's a series of things you got to do across that. And there's a debate today about the premium support for healthcare. You know, my dad was a pediatrician. If he wanted a second opinion, there was another medical professional. Today, the second opinion is calling an insurance executive whether you can get that procedure or get that medication. I was talking to him when I was in Iowa. I was talking to a nurse. She says she spends 50% of her time on the phone battling insurance companies. Today, average kids coming out of college, not that that's the only thing you do post high school, the average debt is $38,000 to $40,000. You want to know why people can't afford a down payment on a home? Student debt.
So does that, so to me, does that need to happen? I mean, that's part of that.
Well, so my
reframing of the dream, like, do you need college 4 years?
Well, I don't want to. Well, I'm assuming we're going to get there, but you don't guarantee that you need college, but you need something post high school. 80% of all jobs in America today require something post high school. I am very proud that we're the only city. I'm a little surprised, still the only city. Learn, Plan, Succeed. To get your high school diploma, you have to show a letter of acceptance from a college, a community college, a branch of the armed forces, or a vocational school. When you walk on graduation day, you got to know where you're walking to. Now, we're all type A personalities in here. We all tell our kids, like, about 4 hours old, start talking to them about what they're going to do. Or at least in the Jewish home, that's exactly what we do. But you grow up with the next
expectation. Your mom did all right with that, too, by the way.
Well, she didn't talk. She yelled at us. But you have to have a plan. Now, I don't really care. You want to go to be an electrician? Great. You want to go to Navy? Great. You want to go Malcolm X? Great. You want to go U of I, IIT, Northwestern, Loyola? Great. But you got to know where you're walking to. And you got to set that expectation. Certain kids get that expectation at home. Here in Chicago, we set that expectation for every child and give them the support to do that. And so to me, do you need a college education? No. But you can't make it on high school alone. But to me, the core part of the American dream is the fact that people cannot afford the home, both for equity as well as for quality of life. The American dream means you've gotten there. Wrote a piece for the Washington Post, what that has done mainly also to young men and the relationship between home ownership and men. But to me, this is a crisis. We have a crisis, and I think there's, and the system is rigged. There's a lot of people in this room, me included, have second homes. We get a mortgage deduction. You got families that can't afford their first home, and other people are getting mortgage deductions for their second home. The system's rigged. You know that joke, paranoid people have enemies too? People think the system's rigged, and guess what? Pretty good gauge. It is. It's rigged against people's success.
How can it be fixed?
Well, you keep doing that. One, you got to identify the problem. Two, like on health care, what you do, you don't send $20 billion to Argentina. You give 20 million Americans their premium support. Let me say this. You got $20 billion going down to Argentina to bail them out. And you got 20 million Americans in the average health care for a family of four today, $27,000. I didn't know Argentina was, I'm glad they're important. I didn't realize they were that important over 20 million Americans. Here's the other thing. Do you think a member of Congress or their staff are missing health care during this government shutdown? You want to get a solution to this problem? You ain't getting any public health care, which is what a member of Congress gets, until the American people get their health care.
So is health care why this shutdown? What's going on with the shutdown as of today? It changes seemingly daily. What, in your perspective, is it health care?
No, I just, look, you can say, I don't want to put my former chief of staff hat on, but since you asked.
You have a lot of hats.
No, and you could.
You had something to do with some healthcare initiative, right?
Let me say two of them. I used to joke at the mayor's office. I said, we created the Children's Health Insurance Program under President Clinton for 10 million children, and then ACA. I never want to work on healthcare ever again. And we spent a lot of time in the mayor's office working on it. But you could solve this problem if you wanted to solve it. The Republicans are asking for what is called a clean continuing resolution. Democrats are asking that we have health care, the premium support, restored. If you really wanted to solve it, you say, okay, you'll have a vote clean on CR stacked with a vote the same day on the health care initiative, back to back. But the White House is exerting no leadership to solve it. And until there's a level of pain where the public tells the members to get going, and I think that will happen shortly, they're going to basically continue to do now the second longest government shutdown in American history. My other concern, having lived through the 95, 96 Newt Gingrich shutdown, but I was mayor but advising the White House during this Senator Cruz shutdown on health care in 2013, this is becoming normalized. And the danger is when we, as a society, say, oh, it's another government shutdown, and you shrug your shoulders. This is not, again, not how a functioning country focuses on the challenges that China and Russia are facing the United States. And we have a lot of challenges, not just because of those two. I want to make this one point. Nothing China does scares me. It's what we are not doing that scares me. And this constant politics of hunger games and Braveheart war where we're battling, pitting one American against another without realizing the challenge is outside, not inside. Outside of America. So Chicago's living through it ourselves right now.
Well, that's what I was just thinking. We can get to that. I mean, government's shut down.
I was helping you on the question.
Thank you.
Yeah.
See, we didn't practice. But really, I mean, where's government's shut down? There's plenty of money being spent. Well, first of all, they're spending a little bit of money on the East Wing, I heard. But there's
all privately raised.
Okay, so all right, we'll move on. That's a waste of time to talk about right now. There's so much. There's a little bit happening in Chicago. There's a lot of money being spent on this Operation Blitz,
Midway Blitz. Yeah.
I don't know where to go with this. What's going on? When does it stop?
And you know, Henry Kissinger once had a line. Do you have any questions for my answer?
Yeah.
So okay, let me help you right here. Okay, so here's what I would say, Dan, on a serious note.
It is a very serious.
Five years ago, I thought and I still think the dumbest thing I've ever heard was defund the police. I never knew that, and I think this is a sequel to Dumb and Dumber. I never knew you to come up with the dumber idea, which is 500 National Guardsmen doing police. And the reason, look, there's a lot to this, but basically it's about putting more police on the street doing community policing and getting kids, guns, and gangs off the street. And then you got to unpack that. But you got to increase your police department practiced and trained to do community policing so they know the neighborhood, they know the community, they know the residents, they know where the troubles are and the good people. Two, you got to put kids in after-school programs, summer jobs, etc. Because when the bell goes off, doesn't mean the troubles end. It's beginning, and you have to have investments. And again, I don't care whether it's artistic, I don't care whether it's athletic, and I don't care whether it's academic, but a child should have a place to go that's safe, secure with an adult in one of those programs at the end of the year or the end of the day. Second is the U.S. Attorney's Office here should be dealing with these gang members. Small percentage of gang members create an overwhelming of the violence in the city. And the federal government should not be saying, here's what we're going to do in L.A., San Francisco, Boston, Chicago, D.C., pretty soon San Francisco or Portland, here's what we're going to do. Pick up the phone, call the superintendent of the police department, call the mayors across the country. What do you need? Where can we invest? Now, let's be honest. Chicago's gang challenge is not Portland's. Portland's challenge is not Chicago's. Call the mayor up. Call the governor up. Call the superintendent, call the head of the state of police. What do you need? Where can we help? And if the U.S. Attorney's Office here, and a lot of mayors before me and mayors after me, have asked the U.S. Attorney to prosecute these gang members, get them off the streets. A very small percentage across the country, but it's also true in Chicago, of individuals commit the overwhelming amount of violence. Target them. Go after them. That's also true about the gangs and the drugs that are coming in here. Give kids something to do. Increase the police department trained on community policing. That's what I mean. Now, again, there's other things, but those are the core aspects of it. But not a single phone call. And let me say one other thing. 500 National Guardsmen, of which a couple hundred are coming from Texas, that are going to be here 6, 8, 7 weeks, is not going to solve this problem. It's a permanent day in, day out, 24/7, 7 days a week, 365 days effort that you have to do to deal with violence. And I think that, to me, what is happening here is, again, one example of why this is not a solution. They're firing tear gas at police officers. How is that public safety? Now, that did not exist pre the National Guard. It did not exist. We have our challenges. Can't deny it. As somebody who spent a good part of his time going to homes and to hospitals, visiting kids that we all know that are senselessly become victims of gun violence, driving parts of our city, having seen the yellow ribbon, the balloons, the pictures, the flowers, from a weekend of senseless violence, this is not a solved problem. We're making progress. We can use intense investment in the core things that can work. But again, pitting one American against another, calling your cities where why we have a Department of War, is insane when you have real enemies, China, Russia, North Korea, Iran, trying to harm us. The people of the city of Chicago are not trying to harm America. It's crazy to me. And it's crazy because we're taking our eye off of the ball. We don't have a person to waste or a day to waste to focus on the future.
One piece of that equation that could potentially be fixed is guns, right? I mean, it seems like there's more guns in America than there are Americans. Perhaps some recent attention. There's a lot of attention. It's always brought up.
Can I say, I keep feeling like I'm going to be wearing this water at some point. No, don't worry about it. I'm just going to move over. I'm easier to move. Don't worry about it, Omar. Don't.
I'll leave.
So, as somebody who passed the assault weapon ban for President Clinton and the Brady Bill, the five-day waiting period, you're not wronging, but you are wrong. The one thing I would say, having worked through this both in the White House, in Congress, and as mayor, saying, okay, this is the thing we can fix as if you solved it. Not true. Just not true. Because if you solve guns but don't change a police department towards community policing, you're not going to solve the problem. Look, Rebecca's here from Wings, been very involved in Wings. 10% of the homicides in Chicago are domestic violence. Changing the law to make sure, and court seems to have allowed this, to deal with the people with domestic violence records and their access to weapons would have a direct effect on homicides. But you got to then deal with drugs. You got to deal with the history of gangs and their ownership of different communities and the terrorism that they in those communities. So to say we got this piece, and as somebody who believes access to guns is important, as a piece of solving it, you have to work on the entire solution, not just a piece of the solution.
And who's doing that right now?
It's not happening.
Can we get into like the future of?
Not happening.
It's not happening.
No. No.
Do we give up? I mean,
no. You, of course not. No. I mean, you have to make sure you got. Look, it's not an accident. A shout out to Superintendent Snelling, who's done an excellent job. He came out of the training facility for the city of Chicago. He trained the officers, the sergeants, the commanders, with the right type of mindset and area, and then is providing day in and day out leadership. Big piece, not the solution. Dealing with hardened gang members, dealing with the fact that you have to have the funding for after school and summer jobs. I mean, you've got to have a comprehensive program. It's too intransient of issue to assume one piece of the equation will address the problem.
So it sounds like there need to be more leaders who understand the depth and breadth of what needs to happen. And I'd like to ask you about two parties, the Democratic Party and the Republican Party, and the future of those parties and who sees those ideas.
We're going to have to order dinner.
I
think there's. I want to say this so it's not heard the wrong way, which is going to be a test to whether I can communicate. When I was mayor, I was obviously very happy, given what I had to deal with and challenges, that I was chief of staff, obviously congressman and senior advisor to President Clinton, but that I was chief of staff before I was mayor. But I think, and please don't tell President Obama this, I would have been a better chief of staff had I been mayor first. Because you have that experience, that knowledge, that kind of as low to the ground would have given you a perspective. Now, I am happy, and this is just the way it turned out, that I was chief of staff also to the president. If for no other reason, I helped Ray LaHood get a good cabinet job and brought a lot of money back, okay? But on a serious note, I mean, that's just how it played out. But I do think I would have been again, let me just say, hopefully it doesn't get lost in translation, a movie about Japan.
Good one. With a hometown actor, Bill Murray.
I was happy that I was chief of staff before mayor. I think I would have been, when I look back in history, I would have been a better chief of staff had I been mayor first.
Yeah, we at City Club appreciate mayors, certainly. We partnered with them in U.S. Conference of Mayors during the convention that was here. And we had all the mayors from different cities. And you remember over many years, mayors always came here to see what we were doing right.
Yeah.
And there's so much here that came out of Chicago that other cities modeled after. And I'm hoping we're getting back to that. Mayors can probably run the world.
Well, definitely every mayor thinks that, so go ahead.
you mentioned in that a couple of things that I just want to touch on. You mentioned that transportation money. There seems to be a factor here. It's a Trump factor that, like, factors into everything these days. Is that red line? What's your not? You did so much to get that, to get the Riverwalk, to get the fun. But now here's finally is coming to fruition with the extension of the red line. Seems to be on hold. Any insight there?
I'm not close enough. I mean,
yeah.
I want this to be heard clearly. It's very funny, ironic more than funny. President Trump kept talking about in his first term, Infrastructure Week. So in the second term, Infrastructure Week seems to be canceling the infrastructure projects. He's canceled the tunnel in New York, canceled the Red Line extension and the Red Line modernization here. So Infrastructure Week has become canceling infrastructure rather than getting a bill done. That's my conclusion.
So the, let's see.
You seem to be struggling here on the
corner. I'm not struggling. There's too many. There's too many. And you're taking
me
in all these great directions.
Okay, go.
So let's get into... you've been very respectful to not criticize your successor. You, Mayor Daley, others, when you left office, you made it a point to say, I'm not going to, being mayor is a very difficult job.
Correct.
And I'm not going to criticize those who follow me as mayor. So I'm also trying to be careful how I state this, because I'm not looking for you to criticize anyone or any previous mayor or any future mayor. But we are in a tough spot in the city right now, especially with all of this funding kind of disappearing and people talking about the city in a way that we know it's not reality. How about this? If you were mayor, or if you were going to become mayor, you know, you still live in Chicago, you could do that. How would you handle this major budget? I think because the budget is a document for all your priorities. How would you handle this gigantic hole that seems to be growing?
Really?
I didn't get any, like...
I'm not violating my principle.
Yeah. No, I really don't want to attack
my predecessor, and I will not attack the job.
Do you have any ideas, though? Maybe you have...
Well, let me... I think we did this successfully, and it's not to say... Look, for 7 consecutive years, Chicago was the number one city for corporate relocations. And for 7 consecutive years, Chicago was the number one city in America for direct foreign investment. And we were not on the coastline. We weren't getting money from China, you know, Latin America, etc. Why? And the answer is we had a growth strategy. And if you have a growth... And look, it was not a linear line. And you joked about being on the notes on the card. But we had a strategy. We had five T's. Everybody on the staff knew how to repeat it. Talent, training, transportation, technology, transparency. And everybody knew how to repeat it. We knew our mantra. We knew how to recruit companies. We knew what our success and what it is. Now, you all in this room used to laugh that I got crazed about how many cranes were in the air. You're not laughing. And to me, the city is a great city. We're a phenomenal city. We're the only global city inland, not on the coast. We have incredible cultural institutions, incredible academic institutions, incredible destination for the Big Ten universities here. We're centrally located with one of the premier aviation systems, get the global terminal built. And the city has all the matrix that stand up a competitive economy that can grow. And if you're growing, not that it solves your budgetary problems, your fiscal, but it makes addressing them a lot easier. Now, the parts that educated and trained workforce, again, at all levels, you have the institutions to back that up. You have a transportation system, whether it's the CTA to the aviation system to Amtrak, etc. You have the cultural attraction, affordability on a comparative basis for the city to grow. And if you're growing, people are investing. And if people are investing, again, not that the budget for the city is solved, but it is easier. And to me, that's the core piece. That was our strategy. We made some tough decisions, irritated some people in this room. But in the end of the day, the city was growing again after decades of actually declining population after 2019 census. City was not only growing population-wise, it was growing economically. That, to me, is a cornerstone for any success rate. And I'm not going to say this is what the mayor should do in this budget, this line. Not my job, and I don't know it like that, like I used to, breathe, eat, and sleep it. But to me, the key to anything, and this also then gets to your other question about parties and stuff like that, we're, as a country, too much, we're taking our eye off of the ball of growth. And let me say one thing you haven't gotten to, but about education, which is, to me, essential. If you look at American history, there are four great growth periods. Post-Civil War, beginning of the turn of the century, post-World War II, and then kind of Sputnik, Apollo, scientific with the Cold War. What is the one constant in these great growth periods? A fundamental education reform. Civil War, land-grant colleges. Turn of the century, universal high school education. World War II, the GI Bill. Sputnik, the science and technology investments we make that build up the great research universities and universities. That's one constant. And I find this weird. You have a president of the United States, National Governors Association. Two-thirds of our kids are not reading or doing math at grade level. It is crazy to me not only that that's happening, but that people in positions of responsibilities and associates are not taking this as a crisis. And we have a crisis. And the adults are failing our kids. The adults are failing the kids. Now, in a period of time, and it's actually solvable. Mississippi, which is really tough demographics, has gone from 49th in reading to 9th. Now, you can look at it as either everybody else is failing and they're just standing still and doing really good. But when you look at the Mississippi miracle on reading and what they did, and you look at what Alabama's done on math, there is a recipe in the elementary years to actually get everybody up to snuff on reading and math. Now, I do happen to think Janice Jackson and our administration actually did something, when I look back at it and think about it, is the biggest reform of high schools, and it came together as a plan, but kind of piece by piece, and then it... One, identifying freshmen on track so you don't lose a child freshman year. It's much more accessible. You can identify that quicker and deal with it. Stuff out the problem and help a child get back on track. Two, the Chicago Star Scholarship. You earn a B average. Community college, tuition, transportation, books, free. First city to do it. Third, bring college education into the high school years. 49% of our kids were graduating with college credit. They were both graduating college credit, saving their parents money, and two, getting the confidence that they can handle post-high school education, which may not be in their experience at home. And then fourth and finally, which I think is first, is the expectation through Learn, Plan, Succeed. Nobody graduates without a plan on what they're doing the next day. Whether it's college, community college, branch of the armed forces, or vocational school, every child in the city of Chicago, and we have challenging demographics. We hit a 97% rate where every child knew whether they're going to go IBW or plumbing or Air Force or Marines or Malcolm X or what. That's how you ensure success. And to me, this is the biggest one of, if not the core challenge, and the adults responsible are looking at their shoes, hoping nobody notices they're in the room. It's crazy.
Doesn't sound like you are.
Well,
I mean, you listen to these insights.
I used to joke that I started the job of mayor 6'2 and 250 pounds, and I'm now 148 dripping wet. I ran for mayor when we came in. William Bennett, Reagan's Secretary of Education, called Chicago public school system the worst in America. It was not a linear line, made a lot of mistakes along the way. We walked out, Sean Reardon at Stanford called it the best public school system, beating 98% other districts in the country on reading and math gains. The city and that child is better when they have an education. They have a passport to go and do anything. And you don't get a do-over. You know how expensive it is to get a do-over for somebody that can't do reading at third grade level? It's crazy. And we're letting this happen. This is not China's fault. This is on us. China didn't do this. We owe it to our kids, and they're our kids, to ensure that they have a good education. And at least on the elementary years, as also on the high school, it's a solvable problem.
Maybe if you were the next Secretary of Education. I hear there's like an open, not much staff these days. It's not funny, but...
Yeah, if you're Secretary of Education, you get a play school phone. It doesn't dial in, it doesn't dial out.
I'm not going to ask the one obvious question, but everybody does wonder. You have all this insight and experience, a resume like,
well, we'll
like
see
nobody.
We'll see if anybody has that. Yeah.
I mean, what do you do with it? What are you going to do with it?
Come here to the City Club and give speeches. Why are we dancing around? So I'm going to evaluate it. If I think I got something to say that nobody else is going to say, and I'm going to be able to say it in a way that I think others don't say it, I'll make a decision. But it's something I haven't decided. I'm not thinking about it. You wake up.
We're very honest here and open.
No, we're not. No, we're not. You and I are not honest. No. But look, I mean, I've lived a blessed life. Nobody's going to check, nobody's eradicating my Wikipedia page. I'm saying this. I am the son of an immigrant who chose to move. My dad chose to move to Chicago. I'm also the grandson of an immigrant who came here in 1914. I have been blessed to work for two great presidents, learn a ton, represent the people of the north side of the city of Chicago, become mayor, and then have the honor to also represent the United States overseas. It's been a great run. I want to make sure that I have something I have left in the gas tank, and I have something I can say that hasn't been said, and an ability to get it done. Not say it, not think it, not articulate it, but then execute it. And if I think I can do that, I'll do it. If I don't, I won't. I check every day spam mail to see if Amy's lawyer has filed the divorce papers. But I'll evaluate him. The idea that you're not thinking about it, that I'm not, is not true, but the idea that I've decided I haven't. Do I think I have what it takes to match up to what I think is both the challenge and the promise of tomorrow? And if I can, I'll do it. And that will be. And if I don't, I won't. And I'll make a decision.
And so much is changing on such a regular basis. Do you think that? I mean, it's disgusting. Anti-Semitism is at I don't know how to qualify it, but at an all-time high. And somehow half the country thinks Chicago is.
Let me, as Rahm Israel Emanuel, help you on that. Okay.
We're not the experts here.
Yeah, it's okay.
Share our stage with those who are.
No. So one is, I don't think anti-Semitism is at an all-time high. It's always there. The question is, do people act on it? That's what's high. But I want to reverse something on that. And that is, when we were living in Japan, and I do want to say, if you got to live in public housing, the ambassador's residence in Tokyo is the way to go, okay? That is public housing, okay? Somebody at our cottage in Michigan spray paint Nazi insignia. And to this day, I don't know who, he or she, have never come up to me. And I've said it a number of times, hoping that one day somebody will. They cleaned our fence for us within 24 hours and got the insignia. So I've seen the worst, and I've seen the best. Now, when I ran for Congress in a district that Dan Rosenkowski, Roman Paczynski, Frank Annunzio, Rod Blagojevich, Mike Flanagan, Rahm Israel Emanuel, and there was ugly comments made, very public by significant people. And I said then, and I really believe, I've met the people of this district. I met them on their front stoop. I met them at the L stop. I met them at the grocery stores. I have all the confidence in their judgment to see hate for what it is and to see a person for who they are. That proved out to be true, not only in that election, every election I've ever had my name on the ballot. So do I think I know anti-Semitism exists. I don't think it's on the rise. I think violence is on the rise. But I have seen the best in people in making their judgment. And I continue to believe and have confidence in the American people, and as I do in the people of the city of Chicago. They see past this. I've been targeted by it. But I have all the confidence in the judgment. What's missing is the leadership to call out. And I'm going to say it, get this. The idea that you nominate somebody for a government position who had been texting about Nazi, Hitler, in an affirmative way. One is, I'm wondering, who is on that vetting committee? How did that get through? And then who are you? The best I can say at this moment is that hopefully it's a teaching moment. You don't nominate somebody that thinks they should be mimicking Adolf Hitler. Where do these people come from? And so the greater exposure is, hopefully there will be a learning lesson here. Not just on anti-Semitism, but on a whole host of bigotry and hatred that's based on ethnicity. And again, that gets back to my big point. The idea that our politics has become Hunger Games is really reckless. And I've participated in my political fighting, etc. That said, many, many Republican friends. And my responsibility when I was in the Congress, besides passing legislation, was to win the House, make Nancy Speaker. I can't tell you how many emails I've gotten from Republican House members and Senate members. While they said they obviously are going to be state partisan, hope that one day I would take the plunge into the deep end of the pool. Not that my head go down, but that I would be able to.
Well, this... lots of lessons here. I have 3 minutes. I was hoping to open it to audience questions, but that was pretty impressive and incredible to hear. You mentioned you'll come back and give speeches, so we're open to that.
Okay.
And we do announcements. We do all sorts of things here, so we welcome you back anytime. We also go on field trips and do great things. We have a great room of civic leaders. This club is incredible. I mean, look at this. I mentioned all those people on purpose because, I mean, this club wouldn't exist. Jackie was our chair. Bob Clark, right there. You know Bob. This club probably wouldn't have made it through after the pandemic, were it not for Jackie, Omar, Bob Clark, Trish Rooney. These people and so many of you others that have been through all this with us, that's what makes Chicago leadership. You don't have to step up. You continue to step up. You continue to in different roles, in every role that I've ever heard. I mean, that's quite the resume, right? If we could leave with maybe a little word of encouragement, we come from Chicago. We come from strong families who care about this city. What can these folks do at a time when things may seem a little lost to do more, do better, and move this city forward and perhaps this country forward?
Now, well, one is, we have a great city. It's a world-class city. Like every city, we have our challenges and greatness. The city is home for all of us. The city has a great future if we take responsibility. And the reason you're in this room, you go back to the fire of in Chicago's history. The relationship between civic leadership and public sector and the private sector is unique. Nowhere else in the country does this kind of partnership exist. And the city's worth fighting for. I think some of the people that decide, oh, I'm going to leave, whatever. No, this is our future. This is our home. This is where we hope our kids will settle. And it's worth, even in the times in which you think you can't solve a problem or can't address an issue, over the period of time, it can get solved if we pull together and there's going to be tough decisions. We got to make, you know, tough decisions. I think I'll get back to what I said. Yeah, look. Jorge Ramirez is here, head of the Chicago Federation of Labor when I was mayor. Before you applaud, listen to the story. I walked in when I'm mayor, and the first thing I have to deal with is that because of coming out of the financial recession was the furloughs. People were down to 4 days a week. And I had to do certain things, and, you know, Jorge had a voodoo doll of Rahm Emanuel, and he was like stabbing it, and so on and so forth. We're dearest of friends. We've worked through all those tough issues. We worked through, I mean, Jorge will have the direct statistic, I won't, but Chicago had more PLA, project labor agreements, than any, I think you said, you used to tell me.
Third state in the country.
Yeah. And so, and trust me, we weren't sending each other Hanukkah and Christmas cards. But we learned to hear each other, learned to listen to each other, and learned to actually work, say, okay, we have a problem. I don't have a problem. We have a problem. What's your ideas? What's your solution? And Jorge was like, we didn't start there. That's where we ended. And we ended out of respect, working through all the tough issues to get to a place, because why? He represented people that loved Chicago, called it home. I represented people that loved Chicago and called it home. And at the end of the day, we realized we had more in common working together. And we didn't start that way, but we learned a lot from each other, and I think I can say that as a friend speaking for both of us. That's true for all of us.
Okay? And I think...
And I was so ready to speak about Japan and the Middle East and Europe. So
hey, I think the city is so far better off because of that.
Yeah.
And because of you, because of folks like you and Jorge and all these in the room, and Michael Sachs, by the way, another one who said to me, "Don't give up."
So let me steal this for a second.
Yeah.
Sorry for not. Jorge and I worked through, and I learned something, which we started on all the big contracts. Before all the negotiations start, give me your 5 A's that you want. I'm going to give you my 5 A's. Come back a week later, tell me which of my A's you can live with, which ones are you going to tell me to go pound sand on, and which ones you can work around. And learning and listening, and don't tell my wife I use the word listening, but learning and listening, we ended up with a great friendship and working relationship, let alone friendship. And it didn't start that way. I had to deal with a furlough, and I had to find, I think it was $75 million, and Jorge wasn't really too enthusiastic with my changes. But that's how we ended up, and we became good friends and worked through a lot of issues, and the city was growing economically.
And Amy's still right by your side.
Yes, as long as she's running on the marathon bike. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mayor. Ambassador. It's great having you.